Hello, and welcome to the Tuesday edition of the KRFY Morning Show. This is Julie Calamine, and a rare treat for me today is that I'm joined by another one of our broadcasters who everybody knows, Susie Prez. Good morning, Susie.
Good morning, and thanks for the invite. This is a subject that I'm keenly interested in.
Well, aren't we all? Jumping right into that topic, what is the subject of this morning's interview? Well, it's Idaho Conservation League, and I've got two of the best people here that we'll be able to talk all about it. Our first guest is you, Brad Smith. You're the interim executive director for the whole darn state. Hi, Brad.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Nice to see you again. It's been a little while.
It has been a while. Thanks for having us.
Of course. We'll have to do this more often because it has been too long. And our second guest is Caitlin Embry. Caitlin, you are the community engagement specialist right up here in Sandpoint.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's great to see you and meet you. So happy to have two folks here to talk about what's going on with Idaho Conservation League. But before we jump into all that excitement, let's hear a little bit about the organization, because it has been a bit since you joined us, and listeners will want a little bit of background before we jump in. Tell us, we'll start with you, Caitlin. Go ahead and tell us, one, how you came to be in Sandpoint and how you got involved with Idaho Conservation League.
Yeah, I moved to Sandpoint full-time about 2 years ago. My family moved here. I'm from Texas originally, and I graduated school with a degree in environmental studies about 2 years ago. Came up to Sandpoint, and I was working with some nonprofits and at Matchwood, and then I saw this job opportunity, and I was very excited to come to ICL, and I actually volunteered 2 summers ago with the water quality monitoring program. Mm. And that's how I came to know about ICL.
Yeah, very good. Mm-hmm. And you just, family just was moving to Sandpoint. You finished college and wanted to jump in and found an environmental organization to fit your skill set.
Yeah, exactly.
That's really cool. Mm-hmm. Well, Brad, your history with this organization is a little longer, so I expect you to go on a bit more, but you've been, you might be the original, one of the originals, are you?
Not quite that old, but I've been at it for about 20 years. Ooh. Now. But ICL was formed in 1973 to protect the air you breathe, the water you drink, and the fish, wildlife, and public lands you love.
That's a succinct and very excellent mission statement.
Yes.
Yeah, it makes it easy. So because you've been roughly 20 years in the area and at ICL for a long, long time, tell us what brought you here originally. How'd you get here?
Well, I grew up in North Idaho, and I spent a lot of time in the backcountry, out in the Selkirks, up the Coeur d'Alene River drainage, down the Clearwater, climbing Scotchman Peak, all the places that we care about. And, you know, that's really one of the most special things about living in North Idaho is access to all these incredible places, the fact that we have clean air, these beautiful, clear lakes and rivers. And one day I was hiking up in the Selkirks and I saw a caribou, and we still had them. And I had, you know, heard about the plight of caribou, but once you actually see them, then you tend to care about things more. So I started learning about the caribou and got really interested in environmental issues, and that led to me pursuing a degree in environmental science and a career in conservation.
Yeah, and it's an amazing career, and you've had quite a number of high points through Idaho Conservation League. We won't jump into those right now. That's history, because we're going to talk about the present. But I do want to get to that, because there have really been some high points over the years. Oh, darn it. Let's just do it. Let's talk about some of those great high points in history of ICL. I mean, really landmark things.
Yeah. So we initially got started to be the voice for conservation in the Idaho legislature. There were small groups around the state in the 1970s, and most of them were volunteer-led. It was really hard to get to Boise for legislative hearings. So they all got together and said, we should have a person who can be at the state house in Boise that can represent our values and not have to worry about getting from Sandpoint to Boise or Idaho Falls to Boise or Challis to Boise, because that's a long ways to travel. And sometimes the Idaho legislature only gives you like 48 hours notice of bills that are coming up from hearings. So ICO was formed to be that voice, and we were a true league back then with different chapters and partners around the state. And since then, we've grown to be a lot more than that. I think what really sort of catapulted ICL in a big way was in the late 1970s. Senator Frank Church wanted to protect the Middle Fork Salmon River Basin. And he was looking at sponsoring legislation to create what became the River of No Return Wilderness. So he and his staff approached ICL and some other conservation groups around the state and asked us to help organize support for that initiative. And that really catapulted ICL into what we are today, which was a professional advocacy group, you know, working to make conservation successful in Idaho. And so we had staff that went out around the state and volunteers around the state and organized support for that bill. And it became the largest protected wilderness area in the lower 48 states in 1980 as a result of that. And to this day, it's still the largest wilderness area in the contiguous 48 states outside of Alaska.
Yeah, kind of a lightning rod, sort of a bring everyone together issue, and you all got your feet under you with this issue.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, you've mentioned that Idaho Conservation League is focusing on the water we love, the lands we love, the people. And I mean, there have been a lot of water related issues that you all have jumped in on. Let's talk about a few of them.
Yeah. And there's a lot of different water issues statewide that we've been involved in, but I'll highlight a few of the big ones that are going on locally right now. Probably the most notable is the Kootenai River. If you were standing on the banks of the river in Bonner's Ferry, you probably wouldn't know that it is polluted. There's a colorless, odorless toxin called selenium in the water. And this selenium is coming from mountaintop removal coal mines in southeast British Columbia. So if you've ever been to Fernie, British Columbia, and you go just a little ways north around the corner to the town of Sparwood and points north, there's a half a dozen different mountaintop removal coal mines. It's metallurgical coal that is sent to China for steelmaking. And these things are massive. Like, they're tearing down entire mountains. And then whenever it rains or snows, the water runs off of these mines into the river carrying selenium. And low levels of selenium are actually good for living creatures, but high levels of selenium are toxic. And the levels of selenium in the river flowing down into Montana and into the United States are now approaching levels where it's impacting the ability of fish in the river to reproduce. The Kootenai Tribe of Idaho, they have had a couple of recovery efforts underway to bring back white sturgeon and burbot for a number of years now. And the levels of selenium in the river are getting high enough that it could basically reverse all the progress that has been made on recovering those fish.
Yeah, and it's a somewhat thorny issue because look at the various entities, political, governmental entities that you've got to bring together. How does an organization like yours try and get those folks together to work on this?
Yeah, and in this case, it gets even more interesting because you're bringing in another country.
Yes.
Three different tribal governments, you know, environmental nonprofit groups from Idaho, Montana, and British Columbia. While it's a really tragic issue, it's also some of the most fascinating work that we do because we have basically built a coalition that we call the Kootenai Transboundary Coalition that has environmental nonprofit partners like Montana Environmental Information Center, the National Parks Conservation Association, And then north of the border, Wild Site. But then also tribal partners like the Kootenai Tribe of Idaho, the Confederated Salish and Kootenai Tribes, and the Tanaha First Nation Council north of the border. And we're all working to try to hold these coal mine, the coal industry accountable for the pollution they're causing in the Kootenai River watershed.
Is there a solution that is viable and really meets everyone's needs, not just the environmental, but the mining companies and Canada? Is there a cooperative solution?
There is. It's just there needs to be willingness. So that the solution would be to put in water treatment facilities that could, you know, treat the water and remove the selenium before it goes down the river. But until that happens, we believe there should be no more coal mining in the Elk River Valley, which is the headwaters area where this is occurring. And these mines generate massive amounts of profit in the billions. It's not like there's a shortage of funding available for industry to implement this. It's just a matter of regulators north of the border holding them accountable. So a lot of the work is focused on getting the British Columbia provincial government and the Canadian federal government to do the right thing.
And what is your hope that this is possible? And when you talk about water treatment, is it a viable solution as far as, you know, you say it's expensive and the coal companies are making a lot of money. So Canada has to put in regulations. It's really,
that's right.
That's the key.
That's right. And one of the big differences between the US and Canada, which most people might actually think the opposite, but the environmental laws north of the border are weaker than they are in the United States. So our federal Clean Water Act has mandatory water quality standards. So they set limits on pollution on the U.S. side in our waterways, and you have to meet those. North of the border, their equivalent of the Clean Water Act, their water criteria are only guidelines. It's like you should have your water be this clean, but there's no mandate to do so. So what we're relying on is actually a treaty between the United States and Canada called the Boundary Waters Treaty. And that treaty says that in situations where water is flowing across the border, the other country will meet the other's water quality laws. So this water comes across the border, does not meet our Clean Water Act standards. So we're alleging that Canada is violating that Boundary Waters Treaty. And after repeated calls over years by all the partners involved, they finally convened representatives from both countries into this thing called the International Joint Commission. And it's a really sort of like bland name, but it's really important work because you actually bring together representatives of both countries, and for the first time ever, tribal governments are part of that process too. And so they are working out solutions. They're all going to have to agree to it, which is the key part. But our hope is that in 2027, the sovereign governments involved, the U.S. federal government, the Canadian federal government, and the tribal governments will all agree on solutions that can be implemented.
And how hopeful are you that that's a possibility?
It's sort of 50-50, to be honest. It's really hard right now, if I'm being honest, to say that I'm hopeful when the United States' posture towards Canada is not good. The America First agenda actually doesn't really help us in this case, because Canada, I think, is like, why should we work with you when the United States is treating us so badly?
Everyday citizens, when they go to the voting booths, can find out who will support this and be an advocate for clean water on the boundary line.
That's right.
Yeah, your representatives, folks. So
a good question to ask.
Yes, it's something important to look up. Caitlin, how do you communicate all these complicated messages to not only supporters of Idaho Conservation League, but just even, you know, on your website and all that? This has got to be difficult.
Yeah, it's a really big project and campaign we're working on. And actually, one of our colleagues is working really hard on this issue and creating a whole campaign complete with a documentary film around this that will be coming out later this year. So right now we're in a stage where we're working on getting all of that stuff up and running so we can run with that campaign later in the year. But it's definitely interesting approach beyond just Idaho or our ICL members and reaching people in Montana and Canada and Washington and getting all the support that we can, because it's not limited to just Idaho, since it is a transboundary issue and it starts in Canada and then affects water all the way out to the Pacific. So,
and you know, this just as a problem among countries and folks, as you say, the tribe and local, regional, you know, in the entire USA is going to be dealing with issues like this. It makes me think about, for example, the Great Lakes. A border, a great big, you know, body of water that we have everyone wanting water and that kind of thing. Rivers that cross borders beyond the Kootenai. Just so many areas that would hopefully be affected by this work you're doing to try and understand a framework that can continue on. I mean, the treaty that you talk about, Brad, how old is that? Is it ancient?
1909.
Yeah. And so here we are working with something from 1909 to try and work in a modern world. Oof.
I think when you hit on the subject of our current relationships, the United States relationships with Canada, that should not even be an issue in my mind. So I'm just advocating for the work you're doing is essential, because water is everything. And I wonder how long it takes for a river like the Kootenai River to recover. And another question is, could there be a water treatment plant on this side of the border as the Kootenai River hits on this side?
So good questions. The geology up there in the headwaters in the Elk River Valley is such that if you, you know, remove a mountain and expose the underlying geology, we're going to have pollution coming out of those sites for centuries to come. You know, there's still mines that the Romans opened in Europe that are still generating pollution. So, you know, there needs to be wastewater in perpetuity. So, you know, like it'd be really, there needs to basically be a fund established that will permanently keep these wastewater treatments facilities operating once they're put into place. And they have to be built up by the mine site. Downstream where we're at, it's just simply too impractical, you know, to try to treat all of the water in the Kootenai River on the U.S. side of the border just be totally impractical. So they really need to be built up in the headwaters near the mines to treat it immediately once it comes off the mine site.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'm thinking about just the importance of what you're working on, and it feels to me like this should be something like, I don't know, NATO. There should be like an international organization, and here's you guys, here are you all, a relatively small organization in Idaho trying to handle something so big.
Well, and even these mine sites in British Columbia are far removed from the centers of power in Canada. You know, Ottawa is a long ways away, and even the provincial capital of British Columbia, Victoria, is a long ways away. So, you know, it's kind of out of sight, out of mind for a lot of Canadians. And we really have to work to try to elevate this issue, and this documentary film that Caitlin was talking about, which is called Shared Waters. The whole goal of that is to really call broader attention, both across the United States and Canada, to this issue.
I'm thinking about your partners that are like you up in Canada. There has to be groups, environmental groups, working with you on this shared water issue, and they have to advocate to Ottawa.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, you know, the Canadian federal government and the BC provincial government are going to be much more likely to listen to their constituents than people from the United States. But I think this is where the tribal and First Nations come in a really important way. You know, we're seeing more and more acknowledgement of tribal and First Nation rights and the injustices that have been caused to them. You know, in the U.S., we've taken a step backwards in the last year and a half or so in that regard. But Canada, I think, is ahead of the United States in terms of acknowledging the harms and injustices that have been caused to Indigenous peoples. And therefore, you know, the Tanaha Nation Council north of the border, the Kootenai Tribe of Idaho, and the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes really have huge voices in this process. And the fact that they were invited in to participate in this international joint commission process is significant because, as I mentioned earlier, it's the first time where Indigenous governments have been brought into the conversation around transboundary water issues like that.
Yeah, amazing. Well, we'll move on from water shortly, but before we do that, you know, it's interesting because I find myself thinking, why do the Canadians care that much about this particular issue? It's all water that's leaving Canada, and then they might be thinking, oh, not my problem. But are there any examples of American USA water going into Canada that might help them, you know, want to cooperate with the U.S. and
I'm sure there
Canada.
Are.
Yes.
There's actually right now a big debate about some mining in the boundary waters in northern Minnesota 100%. That I'm sure could impact Canadian water quality. But there's probably other historical examples or existing examples as well. And I just don't have them on my head right now. But
no, that's okay. But I mean, it might, I would think it could be helpful if Canadians had something of concern on their side that could hopefully balance this
tariffs
situation. Oh, yes, tariffs. Oh, dear. All right. And so throughout the state, and of course, Idaho Conservation League does work to conserve the entire state. Are there any other big water-related projects that you're trying to move forward on?
Yeah. So some of our listeners are probably curious about what's going on with Trestle Creek. That's, you know, been an issue in the community of interest for the last few years. And where that's at currently is some folks who've been out, you know, near Hope or near Trestle Creek have probably seen that there is unfortunately some construction happening on site. We are in the middle of litigation trying to stop that project. We did seek, but were unsuccessful in convincing a judge to put an injunction on the construction until the case was ruled on, and that request was denied. So the construction does continue, but we are still in court and hope for a ruling sometime this year on that.
Okay.
Meanwhile, over at Priest, some of you are familiar with the Kulin Wetlands, which is at the very south end of the lake. It is one of 13 Class 1 wetlands. And Class 1 wetlands were a category identified by Idaho Fish and Game as a rare, very rare type of wetland. And it's, in this case, basically a peat fen. So like kind of a peat marsh. And the peat layer is like 80 feet deep or something. And it's got these rare plants in there, and it's really great habitat. Well, the property was purchased by a developer. The developer is Tricor Investments, and they went through a process at the county level to subdivide the property in a way that you wouldn't normally create a subdivision. They basically used a loophole that existed in the code at the time and used a series of quit claim deeds to subdivide the property one chunk at a time. And then in order to build anything out there, you have to fill everything in, and you lose all the habitat and all the wetlands and all the values that that provides. So we've been monitoring the situation. They do need a permit to fill the wetlands. And so we've been out there monthly. Our Jennifer Ekstrom, who's on our staff, goes out every month to check and see that they're not filling anything in without a permit, because we've seen a lot of examples around here where people will act first and seek permission later. Mm-hmm. So we're monitoring that situation and working with some of the members of the Priest Lake community to try to preserve those wetlands.
Yeah, to be a little more of a watchdog. So, you know, your tools as an organization are, one that we're talking about would be some litigation. And then you can also be a watchdog and call out what you're seeing. What other tools does Idaho Conservation League have to try and bring attention? Caitlin, this might be a good one for you. What are your tools that help raise the awareness of the public and help move you forward?
Yeah. Before, some tools before we get into litigation that hopefully, you know, we like to do these first is the education and awareness. So we'll do events and we'll communicate with members of the public, ICL members and a general public audience. We do a lot of digital advocacy work. So
what does that mean? What does that
mean? So we'll ask people to take action. So we'll put out a call to action via an email or a blog and ask people, hey, this issue is going on. Will you reach out to your legislator? Will you make a call a representative, send an email, or sign this petition? And then that goes to them, or a public comment period where you can submit a public comment to DEQ, for example. And so that's a really good way to activate the public and get broad support and get those large numbers that really help to have a lot of people behind the issue. So those are some ways that we go about activating members of the public on these issues. And speaking of water, one way that we do monitor the water locally to keep an eye on these things, such as Trestle Creek, is our water quality monitoring program that we do every summer. And so that's another way that we can educate the public and get people out there taking that science and data collection. And we get citizen scientists out there, so it's all volunteers. Get people out on the water, because a really good way to get people interested in these issues is to connect them with the landscapes and the areas that these things are happening in. And having that personal connection makes it so much more powerful and meaningful, and you're more likely to care about these issues.
Yeah, I can see that as an important way for people to actually experience what's happening. Because, you know, these are really interesting topics, but they could also be a little dry, right? And so how do you make it, one, interesting, and two, easy for folks like me or other volunteers to really get on your side and help?
Yeah, we try to do as many diverse events as we can and cater to a lot of different audiences. With this program in particular, we do two trainings at the beginning of the season, and it's open to the public. So even if you are not 100% sure you want to join this program, you can come to the training and learn about it. And from there, you can decide if you want to do it or not. And it's really open to everyone. No scientific experience or background is required. Once you do the training, you're a certified steward, and then you can go out there and take samples. So we make it really easy. We have a variety of age ranges, people out there doing the work. We have kids, adults, we have families. So pretty much anyone can get out there once you're trained. And we try to keep it accessible for everyone and approach this information from different sides. So we have the data, we have the science, but that's not appealing to everyone. So we try to approach it from a more personal, emotional side as well.
Good. And what does that look like then when you're, you know, how do you do that? Do you try and engage entire families? You know, what works?
Yeah, that's definitely been something that we're working on now, is trying to engage more families and younger audiences. And so just getting out there and going to events that aren't ICL events and tabling and meeting new people. And sometimes it's just throwing a bunch of stuff at the wall and seeing what sticks, seeing what people like, trying a bunch of different types of events. And then that personal appeal is like really the emotional appeal is getting people out there in the landscape and hearing their stories and then having them share their stories or having staff share their personal stories of their experiences out in the water and what it means to them. And people can really relate to those. So
that makes sense, having that on the website and then being able, letting other people experience, hopefully, what these folks have.
Yeah.
Well, Susie has just written me a note that we're 30 minutes in and we're still on water. So as much as I would like to spend the whole hour talking about water, we're in North Idaho and it's all about water up here. We've got to cover a few more topics here. So, we've got, in my notes from you all, I've got in a highlighted part of it that we want to be covering, talking about the Idaho Panhandle Public Lands Initiative.
Yeah.
That's a big deal.
Yeah, right? It is.
That's big. Let's talk about that.
I mentioned earlier, you know, our ICL's history of involvement in getting the Frank Church River of No Return Wilderness protected. Public lands issues to this day remain part of ICL's DNA, and we've got a lot of protected landscapes in central Idaho, but in the north, we actually don't really have much.
Let me pop in and say we have immense numbers of acres of federal and state land, but it's you're just telling me it's not specifically protected.
That's right. So
yeah.
In the inland northwest, if you were to take like eastern Washington, northern Idaho, and northwest Montana, there's about 9 million acres of public land. So Forest Service, Bureau of Land Management, a little bit of Fish and Wildlife Refuge, but not much. Of that, less than 1.5% is protected in two wilderness areas, the Salmo Priest Wilderness in northeast Washington State and the Cabinet Mountains Wilderness. But there's nothing in North Idaho, north of the Locksaw River. We have amazing wildlands left, but they're increasingly at risk from, development. And, last year the U.S. Congress talked about land sales. Hopefully that'll never happen.
Yeah, and I've got to jump in again because in the state of Idaho, there's plenty of conversation about Idaho State Forest possibly being sold and, mm-hmm. Revenues collected, but it doesn't seem to have been a big part of the federal conversation, right? U.S. Forest Service. But now you're saying that it's starting to come up.
Well, last year, about a year ago, when Congress was debating the Big Beautiful Bill, Senator Mike Lee from Utah proposed selling some public land to finance tax cuts.
Oof.
And in hindsight, that was actually kind of a gift for us because people came out from all walks of life to oppose that idea and show their support for public lands. I mean, not only environmentalists, but hunters, anglers, off-road vehicle users, hikers, backpackers, I mean, you name it. Only a very limited minority thinks that's a good idea. And we've actually done polling in Idaho that shows that 96% of Idahoans think that public lands should stay in public hands, which is incredible. I mean, Idaho's a pretty conservative place, but public lands are part of our identity. And even if you're conservative, you still want to go out on these places to go hunting, to go fishing, to go camping, to do all the things that are central to like Idahoans' identity.
Yeah, I mean, regardless of your political perspective, conservative, middle, liberal leaning, these are the reasons. These lands and waters are the reasons that we come here and cherish where we live.
That's right.
Yeah, and so it ought to be a non-political conversation.
Yep.
Yeah.
So some of these public lands, right, are places where they're multiple use lands. There's some places where timber harvest occurs. There's some places where motorized recreation occurs. There's also some very special places that should be protected in as natural a condition as possible. And that's why we have the Wilderness Act, is that we can, so that we can set some areas aside and leave them just the way they are for not just current generations, but also people that are not yet born, who should be able to experience some of these places the way that we do today, or to have them continue to be places for wildlife habitat or sources of clean water. But we don't have any wildlands in North Idaho that are permanently protected in that way. And so we're seeking to change that. Now, it's hard to get a bill through Congress and protect a wilderness area or a national park or something like that. And in order to get it done, it can't just be environmentalists proposing it or it won't happen. So 2 years ago, we started reaching out to different groups in Bonner and Boundary counties. So off-road vehicle clubs, snowmobile clubs, the timber industry, tribal governments, sportsmen, sportswomen, and said, hey, we're reaching out to explore forming this group we want to call together and see if we can get, you know, support for protecting some of these special areas while recognizing there's probably some things they want to see happen too. So collaboration is another one of those tools in our toolbox that we have, where we will work with different representatives and interests in the community to try to get things done. And so 2 years ago, we formed the Idaho Panhandle Public Lands Initiative to work on public lands in Bonner and Boundary counties to see, you know, if we could get places like Scotchman Peaks, Selkirk Crest designated as wilderness, while recognizing that, you know, some of those other interests at the table probably want something out of this too. So, for example, the snowmobile club here in Sandpoint, the Panhandle Winter Riders, they ride a portion of the Selkirk Crest kind of up in that upper Pack River area. And they're like, well, we think we could get behind your wilderness proposal for, you know, Long Canyon and Parker Creek and kind of the northern part of the Selkirks if we can create a recreation area in the southern end of the Selkirks that would, you know, still be close to logging and mining and road construction and for all intents and purposes be managed like wilderness, but allow some snowmobile use in the wintertime. So it was a compromise, but still gives us a level of protection and gets their support for wilderness designation in the northern Selkirks and then expansion of the Salmo Priest Wilderness into Idaho. The Salmo Priest Wilderness currently stops at the Washington-Idaho state line. We're proposing to expand it into Idaho. And then they're like, there's not a whole lot of opportunity for people that like to ride dirt bikes around here. So can we create a few more motorized trails? So we spent 2 years at the table breaking bread and trying to come up with a package deal that everybody around the table could support. And in May, we just did that. The recreation area that I talked about, it's about 32,000 acres. The Selkirk Wilderness in the northern Selkirks is 39,000 acres and some change. We're proposing to expand the Salmo Priest Wilderness by almost 17,000 acres. We want to designate the Upper Priest River from the Canadian border down to Upper Priest Lake as a wild and scenic river. That's about 20 river miles. And then we've got about, you know, a half dozen single track motorized trails that we want to add to the trail map. So we've spent a lot of time in dark meeting room, well, not dark meeting rooms, in meeting rooms late at night, trying to, you know, after work, trying to work this out. And we were successful in doing that in May. And so now our group is kind of starting the next phase of our work, which is getting broader support from the rest of the community. So we're going to start doing presentations to, you know, the Chamber of Commerce, the Rotary, to the Sportsmen's Association, and start trying to gather endorsements at the grassroots level. You know, we will want just members of the community to sign a petition that we're going to start that supports this initiative, all with the eventual goal of getting one of our members of Congress to sponsor legislation to act to get this into law.
What I'm hearing is collaboration is all the people come to the table and find common ground, and it's there. And so the work that you're doing is vital for to be a voice for that common ground collaborative work. And everyone can win. It can be a win-win because you're doing one thing. You're preserving the wilderness.
That's right. And, you know, collaboration has kind of become a lost art this day and age. You know, there's a lot of divisiveness in our politics and our discourse in the United States. But I think this is what most Americans want us to do, is for people to sit down and work things out rather than being so hyper-partisan. Because, you know, if you do sit down, you might actually find that you share some things. You might share some common values, and you're not as far apart as you thought. And these are the types of things that if you can make them happen are also durable and lasting. Whereas, you know, if the president signs an executive order and takes unilateral action and it doesn't have the support, then the next president can come in and just undo it. And these types of collaborative solutions, they have a much longer shelf life.
Is it your hope that if this initiative is successful, it can become something that would be a model for not only the two counties we're dealing with, but the state and maybe the nation? Is that where we're going? Or
I wish I could take credit and say that this is a model that we created, but it's actually based off, it's modeled after this type of solution or this type of collaboration. It actually happened in the Owyhee Canyonlands down in southern Idaho in 2009, where Senator Crapo sponsored a bill that was developed by a group of environmentalists and ranchers and off-road vehicle users and tribes that came together in Owyhee County down in the very southwest corner of the state.
Much different landscape down there.
Much different.
But the issues remain, right? Same issues, different trees and shrubs, et cetera. But so a successful model there has to give you some hope.
Yeah. I mean, we still have a lot of pushing uphill on the boulder to get this over the top, but we have to try. We have to. I mean, these places are so special, and we owe it, you know, to people alive today and people yet unborn to do something with these special places while we still can.
One thing that comes to mind as we're talking about these things, water, land, and air is part of it too, is once it's gone, it's real hard to get it back.
That's right.
So being proactive, the work you're doing is proactive. And I love the thought of collaboration. And as far as Crapo sponsoring a bill, those ranchers and the environmentalists are a voting bloc.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they want the vote. So it makes sense. But also they probably love the Idaho and what it stands for. So it was a win-win.
Absolutely.
Well, I'm hearing that there's got to be a lot of communication with constituents, you know, just the general public, and then you're working on educating the legislators. What does that look like for you, Caitlin? Such different, disparate partners that you've got to try and connect and help them understand and empathize with other groups. How do you do that? What is that like?
Yeah, so we're kicking off our public outreach and engagement, and we had our first event last week in Bonner's Ferry, and we had about 8 people show up, and it was a solid first event, but it's really interesting to be reaching out beyond just our ICL members and engaging people that wouldn't necessarily engage with ICL or don't necessarily agree with everything that we do, but we have to find those common values and that core ground that we both agree on. And I think the committee that made this proposal has such a diverse background that gives us a really good foundation to stand on. And so as we do these events for the public, we have a long list of people just on the committee already before we begin building that petition list that draw in people from different backgrounds. So I think that'll help us a lot. But we do have an event coming up in July on Thursday, July 16th at Evans Brothers from 6 to 7:30 p.m. And that'll be another event. It'll be a science pub on the Idaho Panhandle Public Lands Initiative. So,
okay. Susie, go for it.
I just wanted you to say that time and place again.
Yes.
At Evans Brothers on?
Thursday, July 16th at 6 to 7:30 p.m.
And the subject is?
The Idaho Panhandle Public Lands Initiative.
Okay. Opportunity.
This seems like a pretty big part of your work right now. Would you say it's highest high priority for ICL, at least in this area?
Yeah, other than, you know, keeping ICL solvent, my biggest programmatic issue is the Idaho Panhandle Public Lands Initiative.
Yeah.
You know, in this next phase of the work where we've got to build broader grassroots and grass top support is a lot of work and a lot of time, you know, in the communities in both counties and meeting with people and making the sales pitch and getting their support. And then I should also mention too that we are still working on the Scotchman Peaks part of this. That was not part of the proposal that the group agreed to in May. We wanted to move forward on the pieces in Boundary County, but we still want to do work to get pieces in Bonner County included in the overall proposal. So there's work being done by Rose Olson with Friends of Scotchman Peaks Wilderness in particular to do outreach in Clark Fork and Hope and try to overcome some of the opposition that we ran into in 2018 and see what it would take to get those communities on board to include the Scotchman Peaks.
And for listeners who maybe don't remember that, you know, the goal for that huge, beautiful, not yet wilderness area is to be able to protect and make it a wilderness area. Yeah. And that is ongoing work that's ongoing and requires an act of Congress, basically. Yep. Yeah.
And although it's a lot of work, it's probably my favorite kind of work. I just personally really enjoy sitting down with people and trying to find solutions and common ground. I just think, you know, humans are social beings, and I just like the social aspect of it and trying to see, like, what we can achieve if we actually try.
Yeah, with good spirit and optimism and with the goal that moving ahead will get you somewhere.
That's right.
And Brad is the person for that. Listeners, you can't see him, but he just has the most engaging way of being in the studio, doesn't he, Susie? He's just a great guy that you just want, you look at him and you want to talk with him.
I want to know more.
Yes.
One of the things you mentioned is keeping Idaho Conservation League solvent and alive. Uh-huh. So that's always the question for nonprofit funding.
Yeah.
If you want to speak for a moment, we're getting there. But
yeah, we are a membership-based organization. So in order for our staff to be able to do the work, we do rely on both the moral and financial support of our membership. So people that are inclined to support us can go to idahoconservation.org and click the donate button at the top. We have a staff of about 24 working statewide and a budget of $3.2 million. So there's a lot of money to raise.
Wow, that I had no idea.
In order to continue to deliver on the conservation that you all value. So that takes up a lot of time just doing the fundraising and keeping the paychecks coming.
Right. Wow.
And another element of keeping a nonprofit organization alive is volunteers. I think about litigation. I don't know how lawyers work with you, but that's a big element, and volunteers in general, but also the legal side of things. So I'm sure you're constantly recruiting, not just with water testing, but all over the place.
Yeah. And, there are nonprofit environmental law firms that are partners when we do have to use litigation. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not making the big hourly rates of some of the for-profit law firms that are out there, but they are super important. You know, like if we're, you know, like Center for Biological Diversity, they're a nonprofit and they're representing us in the Trestle Creek case. And we've also worked with Advocates for the West out of Boise on things like Stib Night, Earth Justice on things like salmon. You know, there's a lot of good environmental nonprofit law firms out there.
So, yes, what I'm hearing then is that you kind of piggyback on some of the legal work that's been done by other organizations, and they can share, you can share resources there. But you do have some staff that helps you with the legal issues.
Yeah. We have 24 staff, as I mentioned, but about a third of those are program staff working on the issues. And then we also have staff, you know, that are working on admin, fundraising, all the, you know, gears that are involved in a working nonprofit.
Of course. And you got to communicate to them too, don't you, yep. Caitlin? So that, is
and
that
community
also
engagement and yeah. comms and marketing.
Is that part of your job too, to communicate with staff and of course with volunteers, but just keeping staff up to date and et cetera?
Yeah, I would say a large part of my role is kind of, I like to say, be the bridge between the program staff and members of the public. So I take what the program staff is working on and communicate that to the public, whether that's through an email, an event, social media, a take action, but getting people informed on what our program staff is working on, and vice versa. If people come to me at an event and tell me there's something they're worried about or a topic, then I can bring that back and point it out so we know to focus on that.
Yeah, I feel like, I mean, having been involved in nonprofit here at KRFY and also other organizations, that can be a key, critical, important part of the organization, everyone kind of understanding the roles and what everyone else is working on, because you can feel a little alone in volunteering or working, doing what you're doing, if you don't really have that connection and someone helping people know what they're doing.
And the connection can inspire.
Yes.
And keep people engaged. So mm-hmm.
That's it.
Great.
Engagement. Well, we are... Hours fly by, Susie, don't they, when we talk with interesting organizations? So in the last, we'll say, 5 minutes or so of our talk this morning, are there key events that we want to be sure we're mentioning other than the July 16th one? Let's jump in while we've got a bit of time.
Yeah, we have some other upcoming events in Sandpoint this summer. So we have a public lands paint and sip event, and that's going to be at Matchwood on Wednesday, July 15th from 6 to 8 p.m.
Okay.
So that'll be the day before our public land science pub. So kind of a tandem event there. And then in August, ICL will be hosting trivia at IPA on Monday, August 10th from 6 to 8. So we'll be there hosting a conservation-themed trivia.
Ooh, fun.
We're working on some questions, so brush up and come out.
Oh, yes. Right.
We'll have prizes. IPA will be donating $1 per draft beer sold. Ooh. So it'll be a very fun event.
That's good. Yeah. That's a nice win-win for both you all and IPA. Oh, nice. And if folks want to find, they may not remember this, even though we'll be playing this interview twice, but if they just want to jump on and find you and find out about events, what's your best contact for them?
For events, we post them all on our website. So it'll be idahoconservation.org to find our events. As social media on Instagram and Facebook is the same. And then they can also reach out to me directly as well.
Okay. And how do they do that?
That'll be my email address, which is cembry@idahoconservation.org.
Okay. And what about Sandpoint Online? Do you use that at all, or should they really just rely on your...
We'll post it in the regional online event calendars as well, so they can find it there too.
Just about everywhere.
Just about everywhere.
Oh, good. Are there still more events, or are these the main ones you'd like for us to be thinking
these
about?
These are the main ones coming up in the next couple months in Sandpoint this summer, and there will be more to come.
Okay, and throughout the state, I imagine you're busy. We don't have to spend lots of time, but similar things happening throughout the state for...
Yep, we have offices in Boise, McCall, and Sun Valley. So
wow.
There are events happening there, too, if any listeners from that region of the state might happen
right.
to be listening.
Well, there can be. We've got people from all over. And Brad, how lucky for you to be interim executive director, and you get to travel to Boise and
going next week.
And what great towns. It doesn't get much better.
Yeah.
It's not like you're going to, like, you know, Cleveland or something.
Chicago.
Idaho is so scenic, so it's fun to travel around and see the different parts of the state.
What about Washington, D.C.? Do you have to appear there from time to time or not?
Some of our staff do. I personally have not been back there for a while, but we have some really smart, well-qualified staff that go back there and know what they're talking about. And I, you know, get to stand up and take a lot of credit for it, but they're actually doing all the hard work and have all the expertise.
All right. Well, we're coming to a conclusion of a really great talk, and it's just flown by. Before we let you go, Brad Smith and Caitlin Embry of Idaho Conservation League, any little last thoughts you'd like to leave us with before we all go on with our days and try to think about conservation?
Well, just thanks for having us. If you haven't checked us out, come check us out sometime. You know, we really care about Idaho and all the things that you likely value about our landscapes and our waterways. And we hope you'll support us. And thanks for having us.
You heard it, listeners. Get on that website and make a contribution if you're able, or get in touch, and there could be some volunteering opportunities that would really help you understand the work you all are doing. All right, well, we're going to conclude, and I once again just want to thank you, Brad and Caitlin, for joining us this morning. Both so smart.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.